Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Walter Mosley, whose latest novel, an E.Z. Rollins novel, is Little Scarlet. Recent books include The Man in My Basement, Six Easy Pieces, Walking the Dog, Fear Itself. Walter Mosley is a distinguished novelist and nonfiction writer. We'll be talking about these books by themselves also in another context, and I normally don't do this, which is give information about myself on the air, but I'm taping this on July 9th, 2004. On July 4th, 2004, actually the 3rd, about 9 p.m., my father died, and I've just got back from New York. 1965, when Little Scarlet occurs, it's partly about the relationship between black women and white men. My father began an affair with a black woman. He married her in 1970, and they were together for 34 years. My father, I always thought of as conservative, this short, fat, bald Jewish lawyer, and he married a black woman in 1970. Let me start there. This is in New York, but there's not that much difference between New York and L.A., and you've
both in America.
And both in America, and according to my father, it's actually, the racism is as bad there as here, when I spoke to him a little bit about it a couple of years ago, because I was saying it seemed that blacks weren't quite as angry on the East as on the West, and he said, oh, they are.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
What was it like, do you think, for both he and Annie in 1970, based upon your own research and everything you know about relations in 1970, 65 to 70?
You know, it's such an interesting question. I think it probably was a little easier on the East Coast. Not because people are less or more angry or anything like that. I think that, but one thing's about from San Francisco down to Los Angeles, most of the people who are transplanted from the South. And so they bring that kind of overt racism, that overt keeping people apart. There's no pressure on them to kind of deal with it. It's like, oh no, listen. You people aren't supposed to be together. And so I think that's actually on a shallow level. I think that you would have that. On a deeper level, the racism isn't the same. But, you know, the thing that you always have to address and that people don't like addressing, it's different according to who the person
they
is.
Are.
There are people who, for instance, can completely ignore what other people think. The pressures of other people. Like, you know, you could have, for instance, a white person fall in love with a black person or vice versa. And really feel that love, but not be able to act on it. An example, and it's not even, it's about race, but not black and white. My cousin Lily, who's a Jewish woman, fell in love with a cowboy, but could never be with him because her father would never have accepted her marrying somebody who wasn't Jewish. She never married. But she allowed that pressure to be on her. My mother, on the other hand, falls in love with my father, who's black. She's Jewish, and my father's black. She just didn't even care. People got mad. They got upset. They yelled. They screamed. They jumped up and down. They did all these things. My mother said, oh, I'm very sorry you feel like that because I'm in love with this man. I'm going to marry him. And so her life was a completely different kind of life. So that's one thing. Of course, you are going to run across racism. My mother tried to take me to get my passport, and they wouldn't give it to me.
Really?
This is in 1968. Tried to get my passport because they said, how could he be your son? They just looked at me. They said, how can he be your son? He's not white. He can't be your son. And they just wouldn't do it. It was an amazing kind of thing. I thought maybe they thought she was trying to smuggle me out of the country so I wouldn't get in the draft. I don't know what they thought. But my father had to come in. But they believed my father. And I'm in between the color of my
right,
mother.
Right, yeah,
mother.
You're light-skinned.
They believed my father
skinned.
Was my father, yeah. But they wouldn't believe my mother was, you know. I think that it's that they certainly, your father probably had his eyes opened every day about things. But how he felt about it is really what makes the difference.
As my sister and I were kind of more my mother's kids, her family became more his kids. So In 1980, my niece was born, and they were very, very close, very, very close. And she was telling me about 1987 or so, him taking her around College Point, New York, which is a very conservative area, and introducing her as my granddaughter. And she's dark.
There's a thing here, a moment. There's something that you're saying, which is interesting, because there's an idea that you would almost think from what you're saying that liberals are not racist and conservatives are racist. There's a woman who I work with who has very, you know, conservative parents who live in the conservative Midwest,
right,
who adopted her. She's black and they're both white, and they raised her as their daughter, and
right,
they didn't, you know, and I think you'll find a lot of people who they'll say I'm a conservative, but they'll say, but I'm not racist. I would, you know, marry. I would raise, stuff like that. I think that that's true. The problem is in what way are you going to be excluded from society and culture? In what ways are you? Now, I don't know where his granddaughter was being raised and how she was being raised and who her friends were, etc. But in College Point, everything was fine, I'm sure. But he's Jewish, right? So, so let's say, to begin with, people say this about my mother. They say, well, you know, you have a black father and a white mother. I said, no, I have a black father and a Jewish mother.
Right, yeah.
And they said, well, Jewish is white. I said, no, Jewish is not white. Jewish is Jewish. All the whole history of 1,000 years in Europe says the Jews aren't white. The first thing in order to be white, both there and here, you have to be Christian. You know, you can't be like, you know, Islamic, and you can't be Jewish and say that you're white. So that's a whole other thing. So whatever your father's experience was, he already had some idea of what it's going to be like.
Well,
if you're being Jewish, you're going to be excluded from all kinds of things anyway.
And in fact, he experienced a great deal of anti-Semitism in the Navy during World War II, which he told me about.
Yeah.
Someone asked to see his tail.
Yeah. Well, no, because I mean, they kind of a deep ignorance that you have about what it is to be Jewish. I mean, almost everybody in America experiences racism. Either they're being racist or they're being prejudiced against. I mean, there's no way out of it. I mean, if you're Irish, if you're Polish, if you're Italian, someone says you're white. You say, yeah. But as a white Irish, you know. I mean, when Kennedy got elected president, the idea of having a Catholic president, I mean, it's such an outrageous thing. And of course, I'm living in the black community, I'm going, but they're white, aren't they? It's Christ, isn't it? You know, but obviously there's this big difference. I mean, America is so versed in racism in so many ways, in such deep ways, that you really have to isolate yourselves, which a lot of people do, in order to think, well, I belong to the majority people, because nobody does in this country.
On the plane ride back, I was reading Six Easy Pieces, which is six short stories, but in a way it's also a novel. It's the previous book to this series, and it struck me that it's all about grief and loss. Even though there are stories, there are mysteries, it's about Easy's relationship with Mouse and dealing with the grief of Mouse's perceived death, and also the grief at the loss of what appears to be the loss of his relationship. Which means you were dealing with that element as you were working on the book about grief and loss as well.
Well, yeah. It's such an important part of life, how we're defined by who we love. And maybe by their love, but certainly by who we love. And Easy's feelings about Mouse, you know, which are so strong, and then about Bonnie, who's his girlfriend, and then about his children, how he loves his children, and how he has to allow that love to form its own dynamic. You know, so when his son says, well, you know, I'm going to drop out of school now and build myself a boat and go off into the ocean. That's what I want to do. And how Easy has to say, well, I'm going to deal with that. It's what life is about. You can't write a good novel without deeper issues, whether it's a mystery or whether it's a coming of age, whatever it is. There always has to be a sense of something being found and a sense of something being lost. If you didn't do that, then, you know, as a writer, you're going to fail, and readers are going to read it, you know, get various things out of it, but not anything necessarily very deep.
You're listening to an interview with Walter Mosley, whose latest book is Little Scarlet. I got the sense that after you killed Mouse, that you weren't quite sure what to do because you knew Mouse had to die. We're talking that first time.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I noticed you wrote science fiction. You started another series, two series, in fact, Socrates Fortlow and Fearless Jones, before going back to Easy after several books. Am I wrong? Did you always know you were going to go back? Did you always know Mouse wasn't dead? How did that work?
I always knew he wasn't dead.
And you did?
I always knew I was going to go back. Yeah. It was very interesting. Even the how Mouse died in Little Yellow Dog was really, the experience is this. I'm writing the story. I know that Easy and Mouse are getting into a tight situation. I know that a guy is going to try to kill Easy. And I know that Mouse is going to kill that guy. I knew all that. But I thought it was just kind of regular. But when I was writing it, I just kind of wrote that Mouse gets hit. Now, of course, then it strikes me, well, yeah, this is the same day that John F. Kennedy gets hit. And there's a deep sorrow that I wanted to connect to. And it was easier to connect to it from Easy feeling a loss about Mouse than was Easy feeling a loss about John F. Kennedy. The whole world felt that loss about John F. Kennedy, or
right.
Easy's whole world anyway felt that loss. And but Easy's feeling about Mouse was the same thing. At the same time, it became apparent to me that this would be really good for Easy. because we can see him in another way. We can see that tragedy we're talking about before. We can see Easy go through it, try to deal with it, try to learn from it, fail learning from it, feel go into it, that sense of pathos and tragedy that's so much a part of Easy's heart. And feel it, and I could follow it all the way through, you know, all these stories in six easy pieces.
So I was wrong in assuming, oh, gee, Walter doesn't know where to go, so he's starting all these other series.
I'm always writing different books.
Right.
I mean, like even before, you know, because if it's only started then, I could understand that. But,
right.
You know, I had already written R.L.'s Dream.
Right, yeah.
And I'd written Gone Fishing much earlier, even though it was about Easy and Mouse, it wasn't a mystery. I always wanted to write different kinds of books. You know, if you look at writers, most writers that you knew and read 10 years ago, you can't find them today. Most writers have a 10-year arc, and at the end of that arc, they're lost. That has to do with a lot of reasons. Sometimes it has to do with the writers themselves. They've written what they needed to write, and they don't really have anything else to say. A lot of it has to do with the commercial interests of publishers, however, especially in genres. We want you to write this book again and again and
people
again.
People get tired, and you get tired.
And then you get tired, the people get tired, and the publisher says, oh, well, you know, we can't sell your books anymore, so we're going to have to give you less money, or actually, we're not even interested in publishing you anymore.
Right.
They loved you 5 years ago when you sold 300,000 copies, but now when you're only selling 12, they say, well, you know, it's not so good anymore. One of the things, I never want that to happen to me.
Well, but on the other hand, I mentioned before Walter Mosley, the mystery writer, but in a sense, I always felt that that was never really the case, that you weren't a genre writer, that you were hiding behind genre, but you weren't a genre writer.
Well, I mean, I am a genre writer in as much as the books I write that are mysteries. They work as mysteries. So in that way, yes, I am. The fact that I do more means that I'm a novelist, and that's an important thing for me. But that's what I think. Maybe it's what you think. Maybe some other reader think. But when you go to your publisher, like, for instance, when I wrote Blue Light, you know, W.W. Norton says, we're not going to publish this. When a publisher tells the writer they're not going to publish one of their books, they're saying, you're going to get in line.
Right.
You're going to get in line. You're going to write these mysteries or out, you know. And so my problem becomes, hey, well, what am I going to do? I had to change publishers. In order to publish that book, I had to change publishers. That's a big decision. Because, you know, I like Norton. They're a very good publisher. But the thing is that you can get limited by people. They can say, and what you're limited by is how much money they think they're going to make. That's what they think. They're how much money do we think we're going to make? And in that, how much money do we think we're going to lose by letting you go do other things? So I did go through a period where, I mean, I don't think that you're wrong, that I did go through a period where I was kind of looking for a voice that could work outside of Easy Rawlings.
Right.
And I think I found that.
With Fearless.
Well,
and Socrates.
Yeah, Fearless and Socrates and The Man in My Basement and
right.
What Next and, you know, whatever else I was writing. But I felt like now I feel like I can do what I want. I can go where I want. And so I can write an Easy Rawlings novel every year. And that's not going to be a problem for me. Because
right.
In the middle, I can publish another book. Because I'm publishing two books a year and I'm completely happy with that.
It struck me that the first Fearless Jones novel, you were kind of getting your voice. But in reading Fear itself, you have it. You can feel the difference in confidence between the first book and the second.
Well, yeah, I got Paris's voice down. Paris is a hard voice because it's kind of comical. And, because he's a, you know, Paris, Easy is like a tragedy waiting to happen. And,
right.
And it's happening all the time. Paris is, you know, he has happy endings. Yeah, you know, yes. You know, he's feeling pretty good. He might have a girlfriend. He might not. He's got some money. His bookstore is doing great. And Fearless is always happy. Fearless is living a good life.
What about the idea of putting Paris and, well, Fearless, not directly, but Paris directly into Little Scarlet, which takes place 12 years after Fear itself?
Well, it was a great deal of fun to put, because, you know, the idea is they're living in the same world. And, you know, Easy, you know, drops by and says, hey, how you doing, Paris? And, well, you know, I had to spend up three nights protecting my bookstore from these people rioting, man, you know. And they could discuss the riots. And one of the interesting things is every black person and every white person you talk to has a different impression of what the riots were, what it meant, what it didn't mean.
How was it for you writing Paris from Easy's voice?
Oh, that was really great. That was really wonderful. Actually, I'm really seriously considering now. I mean, I'm probably 80% convinced that I'm going to write a novel about Mouse, period, from Paris's point of view.
Really?
I'm pretty sure about that. I'm going to write, and I'm going to call it Tail. T-A-I-L.
Do you know the era yet?
No. I don't know. I know what it's about, but I don't know when exactly.
So you had said way back when Dick and I interviewed you, I think the first time, that there would be a time, because since Mouse lives on the edge, that you would have to kill Mouse.
At some point, yeah, he's going to have to go.
But I thought you did it. How can you?
No. He didn't. It wasn't then, you know. I mean, it wasn't then, you know. And it really, that was so great, you know. And doing that, I could bring back, in him getting shot, I could bring up back some characters that I really love. Mama Jo.
Right.
She's just the joke.
From Gone Fishing.
Yeah, and Domac, her son, who is just, I just love that guy. You know, he's just so insane. You know, one of the things is that, you know, writing about black characters, I mean, there's so many interesting black characters that come from so many different points of view. It's, you know, and that, you know, in white literature, which, you know, most of America is, you have every different kind of character that you can imagine, you know. But in black characters, there's a kind of a demand for a kind of a continuity in what those characters and protagonists are like. You can't go into some crazy place like Domac, you know, who, you know, you can't even tell who he is. He has this great relationship with in Gone Fishing with this white woman, you know, who invites him into her house, and she puts two tables in her kitchen because they can eat together, but they can't sit at the same table. And, you know, there's a kind of a weird equality going on. I just love writing about these characters. And one of the things, the great things about writing, you know, it's like, and I can't stay writing the same thing, like time after time after time.
What's the origin of Walter Mosley, of Six Easy Pieces? It's a strange book because I expected it to be short stories, and they are, but yet there's this overriding thematic sense, and it's about Mouse. I mean, it's about Easy, Mouse, and Bonnie that covers through. It's like watching a serial TV show with longer story arcs.
Well, now, so here's how you can explain it. This is very much based in capitalism, but it's aesthetics based in capitalism. I had a couple of problems. I had a contract outstanding that I had to meet, and I had a series of books that I wanted to be selling, meaning to say my backlist of E.Z. Rollins. I had left Norton. I was at Little Brown, but I had a relationship with Pocketbooks, now Atria. And I said, well, listen, what I'll do, I'm not going to give you any book that I promised you before. I'm going to do that somewhere else. But I will write seven short stories, which you can re-release the backlist, and you can put a story in each one so people can read it. But in my head, I'm saying, but I'm going to connect these stories, and I'm going to make them work, and so they can be a book, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, and so I write the book, which they agree to publish, but we also can re-release the backlist with these stories, and so everybody's happy, it seems.
The last story in that book is original to the book, and it's actually a prequel to Little Scarlet.
Mm-hmm.
When you were writing that book, well, that story, had you begun Little Scarlet, or
no? You know, I wanted to find a bad guy, you know, because Easy usually figures out who did it, and, you know, makes them answer in one way or another. There's that whole notion that you can have a serial killer working in the black community, and nobody knows it. And then you have the police telling you, well, all serial killers are, you know, middle-aged white men. Well, yeah, because those are the only ones you're looking for. But, you know, if you have a serial killer who's working solely in the black community without a signature, I mean, say, like, you know, saying, I did this for each crime, the police don't have no idea that they're doing it, because they're not that concerned with deaths in the, you know, in the poor community and the black community. And if, you know, somebody's not dropping them, you know, on the freeway, they say, well, you know, that, you know, this woman got killed. She got killed by her boyfriend, of course, you know. And then they go out and they arrest the boyfriend. And the boyfriend has to prove he didn't do it. And so I wanted to make it really hard for Easy. So that we have this guy. Easy proves one guy's innocent, but he can't prove the guy who did it, and he can't find that guy. And so then to bring that into Little Scarlet, and then add in, you know, the other issues, like, you know, well, this is the 5 days after the Watts riots. This is Easy dealing with his children. This is Easy dealing with his girlfriend. This is Easy dealing with falling in love with somebody who represents his past. Then I have the kind of complexity that can make an interesting novel.
The Man in My Basement, Walter Mosley, in reading the book, it struck me that the book is, it's got the issues of race and all of that, but it's a book about guilt. And in particular, even though our main character, the man in the basement, who's decided to deal with his guilt by locking himself in a cell, he's just a guy who's a businessman who's got blood on his hands, I kept thinking back to that this was written post 9/11 and it was written with the Bush administration in Washington and Cheney there.
But it was written before.
Was it really?
Yeah, I wrote it before 9/11. It was published post 9/11 by far, but I written it about, I think, 1999, okay. Maybe even a little bit earlier, because I've always had the same criticism. Remember, you know, I've always had the same criticism of America. Bush and Cheney and Ashcroft and all the, you know, Condoleezza Rice and all these people, they've carried this to a great extreme, America's, you know, kind of, you know, economic imperialism. But it always existed. The
right.
possibility for them to be there has always existed, and that's why I wrote this book. And so when you have this man who represents that evil, but who's not – he is evil, he works for evil, but he's not a bad guy. And then you have my black protagonist, Charles Blakey, who is innocent, but he's not a good guy. To have them together and to see what happens when they have a discussion, when a, you know, you have – because one of the things I think is that, you know, black America hasn't internationalized. We are the – most powerful, most influential, and wealthiest group of black people in the world, but we don't look beyond our borders enough. We don't worry about Rwanda or Sudan or Iraq or Afghanistan enough. We need to be worried about that. The black community, because of globalization, because of our interests all over the world, because since 1950 at least, you couldn't sell a grain of rice in China without it appearing somewhere on the stock market, that without paying attention to the whole world, there's no way for us to help each other. It was okay when we were trying to, you know, get the yoke off our back in America. And I'm not trying to say that it's completely off yet. But at this point, it's off enough that if we can't rise above America, as our jazz greats have done. I mean, really, the people who did it were the people in jazz. Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington. These people actually rose above America. But all of us have to. And there's no way that we can deal with problems inside of America without recognizing what America's doing in the world.
I was wondering what element that is. There's the strange subtext of the Prince of Madagascar and Bonnie's relationship with him and his comments about getting rid of American imperialism and how Easy Rawlins deals with that. I mean, he's got both the personal and the political there.
Bonnie's, dalliance with this African prince in Madagascar will show up in later novels, and it will force Easy to be aware of the world on a more international level. It's already started a little bit. He already has a girlfriend, you know, who's from the Caribbean, who works for Air France. So he's already being, you know, exposed to the world to a small degree, but he's going to be exposed to it to a much larger degree as the novels go on.
You're listening to an interview with Walter Mosley, whose latest book is Little Scarlet. Do you see yourself making those kind of changes in either the Socrates Fortlow stories or in the Fearless Jones Paris stories?
Well, Fearless in Paris. I mean, you know, Fearless knows all this stuff kind of intrinsically, whereas Paris is very, very parochial. Socrates is going to become a philosopher, and how that philosophy works out, I'm not really quite sure. But I know that it is going to work out. It's always going to be on a very small, in a very small place, like, you know, like the Greek philosophers. It's going to be very small, but it should have ramifications to a much larger theater.
Do you see yourself going back and writing more science fiction? There is Futureland, too.
Well, I just wrote a book called 47, which is a young adult novel about a slave on a plantation in Georgia in 1832. His name is 47. And also his number. He's 14 years old. He makes a friend called Tall John, based on, you know, the African, the slave myth about the guy who comes from Africa to save us, called High John the Conqueror. Tall John turns out not to be a runaway slave or even a human being. He's an alien who spent thousands of years looking for this boy, in order for this boy to work with him to do some very large task. So it's a historical novel with a science fiction base, which I've written because, you know, of the great thing of that you can do with science fiction. Once you bring in science fiction, you don't have to pay attention to history anymore. You could say, well, you know, like if you wrote a book about the future, you could say, well, in the year 2231, there were no more men on the face of the earth. Well, okay, it's true then. There are no more white people on the face of the earth. Okay, it's true. In this, I'm doing it in the past, but it's okay because it's a hidden past.
Well, the idea about science fiction is you're really only writing about today anyway.
Well, always, yeah.
Always. What other books do you have in the works?
Well, I just finished a new Easy Rawlins novel.
Oh, you did?
Called Cinnamon Kiss. That'll be out next summer. And I'm writing a book about a black deconstructionist historian.
What did you think of the HBO movie Always Outnumbered?
Oh, I thought it was great. It was what a wonderful movie. It's a, you know, it's a movie that you can't say it's like any other movie, and that's the first thing I love about it. And Lawrence Fishburne and Cecily Tyson and Natalie Cole were all great in everybody else. Michael Apted's just a fantastic director. It was a really beautiful film. I was very, very happy with it.
Do you plan to have any? I know Devil in the Blue Dress was not hugely successful, but I thought certainly, I mean...
Well, critically, it's become very, very successful. It's actually, you know, it's almost a classic. Not quite, but it's on its way to becoming one. I'm trying to do a TV series of E.C. Rollins now with USA. I've written the pilot. Maybe they'll want to do it. Probably they won't, of course. You know, this is always the way. But, you know, one can always hope. The first person I would ask to play Mouse would be Jeffrey Wright. Would he bring to the thing what Don Cheadle did? Of course not. Don is a great actor and can't be questioned on any level. But, you know, there's a lot of great black actors, you know. And, you know, the fact that, you know, only one or two of them rise to the top, you know, and Don has not nearly made it to where he should be, I believe. But I think Jeffrey would do a very good job.
Are there any other things in the works in Hollywood then?
A woman named Dion Fearon is producing The Man in the Basement right now. And that would be a very interesting thing, you know, a small film.
Walter Mosley, one final question about politics of today. I'm still trying to get a handle on getting rid of Bush, and I still don't understand why, after all that's gone down, this guy is leading in the polls.
Well, he may. I don't understand the polls. I didn't believe the polls. The polls talk and they say things, and you know sometimes they're right, and those are the times that they refer to. Often they're wrong, and nobody ever refers to them. I don't know why. Kerry's going to win the election. I don't have any question about that in my head. I have no question that he's going to win the election. That the people, people who got the working people who got tax cuts know that they're paying an extra dollar for a gallon for gas, and so their tax cut is gone. People know, yeah, well, there are new jobs in America, but I used to work for McDonnell Douglas. Now I just work for McDonald's. People, understand that there are no weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden weren't in bed together, that the war is an illegal war. Everybody kind of knows that. They might still think that we had to fight it. They're wrong, but they might still think that. But I think that the real energy behind Bush is waning and that the Democrats will win. Now, that being said, so what? I mean, the Democrats haven't necessarily done a better job than the Republicans. Both of them are not really political parties, but they're interest groups. And the interest groups that are based on money. If you give me enough money, I'll do what you want in the Congress or in the White House. And so we have a long way to go to make America work.
You've been listening to an interview with Walter Mosley, whose latest novel is Little Scarlet. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.